Now, for those who are new to the story of Ruth, we're gonna do a brief recap, kind of a retelling of the story to bring us up to our point in the story. If you're really familiar with the story, just bear with us for a minute or two. But we just want to try and bring everyone to the same place, and so we can get the most out of today's text. So the story of Ruth, it's set in the time of the judges. It's the book preceding Ruth, and this was a very dark period in Israel's history. It was described as a time when everyone did what was right in their own eyes. It was an era of wickedness, of rebellion, of selfish ambition. As the story of Ruth opens up, there's famine in the land, and the land there's drought, and there's no food, and this is an act of God's judgment against the wickedness that's been going on. But it's also an opportunity that God provides for people to return to Him, to repent of their sin, and to look to Him for goodness and provision again. Now, in light of the famine, there's this family, Elimelech, his wife Naomi, and their two sons, and they decide that they're going to put their hope in a foreign land called Moab. It's a place that was known for pagan worship. It's a place that they were known as a people that were enemies of Israel. And Elimelech decides to move his family away from God's promised land. And this is a symbolic picture of moving away from God and His promises and trusting a pagan country and pagan idols. So the family, they settle in Moab, and the sons marry Moabite women. But things don't get better for the family. It doesn't go well. Hardship falls upon them, and Elimelech passes away. He dies. And then the two sons die as well. And Naomi and her two daughters-in-law are left destitute and seemingly without hope. Now, however, Naomi receives news. She hears that the famine has ended in Israel, and so she decides to return to her home in Bethlehem. Now, at Naomi's prompting, one of the daughters-in-laws, Orpah, she decides to stay back in Moab. But the other, Ruth, in loving kindness and devotion, she pledges herself to Naomi and to her people and to her God, and she returns with Naomi to Bethlehem. And when back in Bethlehem, they still remain without provision. So Ruth decides that she's going to go out into the fields and she's going to glean from the fields whatever she can, and she hopes to come home with enough food for Naomi and herself for the evening meal. But by God's providence, Ruth happens upon a field that's owned by a near relative of Naomi's husband, Elimelech. It's a man named Boaz. And Ruth finds favor and kindness from Boaz and is able to glean an abundance from the field. She comes home with this 50-pound sack of grain. It's amazing. When Naomi sees this, she's amazed, and she says, "Well, how did this happen?" She says, "I met this dude named Boaz, and he was really nice to me." Well, eventually, Naomi hatches this plan. She's like, you know, this is kind of a good connection here. She hatches this sketchy plan. She encourages Ruth to engage in a surprise midnight rendezvous with Boaz in order to propose to him. It's above board in many respects, but she says, go and do this, and it'll be a proposal to him. Well, Boaz is very receptive. He's blown away by this kindness of Ruth, and he says he's willing to be a redeemer and to marry her. But he said there's a problem. See, there's a man, and he's actually first in line to be a redeemer in this family. And so I can't actually just go ahead and marry you. I can't redeem you first. We have to settle this matter with the Redeemer who's first in line. And this is where we pick up the story with Boaz about to resolve the issue. So we're in chapter 4 of Ruth, as Steve mentioned, page 224 in the Seat Bibles. And why don't we stand, if you're able, just as a sign of respect as we read God's Word. Ruth 4, 1 through 12. Now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, "Turn aside, friend, sit down here." And he turned aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here." So they sat down. And then he said to the Redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you. And he said, I will redeem it. Then Boaz said, the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth, the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. Then the redeemer said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it. Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the redeemer said to Boaz, buy it for yourself, he drew off his sandal. And then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and to Mahlon. And Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day. Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman. Please be seated. So as we pick up the story in chapter 4, we see that Boaz, being true to his word, has quickly set out to settle the matter between himself and the kinsman redeemer who's first in line. Now, a kinsman redeemer is a close male relative who, according to Old Testament law, had the privilege or responsibility to act on behalf of a relative who was in danger of losing their land or having their family line cut off. So a kinsman redeemer would act to redeem or purchase the land in order to keep it in the family line as a means of ongoing provision for that family. Or the kinsman redeemer may step in to marry a childless widow of a near relative in order to preserve a family line. So our passage, it's focused on two kinsman redeemers. There's Boaz, and there's the redeemer who's first in line. And we're going to see an overarching theme that comes out of the passage, and it's that of preserving one's name. We might call this having an enduring legacy. Or we might say that preserving one's name is having lasting greatness. And as we explore the text, what we're going to discover is that lasting greatness doesn't come the way that many would expect. So let's look at verse 1. So now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there. And behold, the redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, turn aside, friend, sit down here. And he turned aside and he sat down. So now, as mentioned, Boaz had received a proposal from Ruth just the night before. So first thing in the morning, he's a little bit excited. He gets up and he makes his way to the city gate. Now, this is the place where legal transactions would happen in that day. It would be the equivalent of going to a city hall or going to a court, and you would go there to have a matter settled legally before your community. So Boaz goes to the city gate, and he waits for the other redeemer, and hopefully he will settle the matter pertaining to Ruth's proposal. Now, it should be noted that Boaz had options. You know, he didn't have to handle the matter in this way. In fact, he could have actually just acted upon what he thought was best for himself. He could have quietly married Ruth, neglected to mention, you know, this other redeemer. I mean, why bother? And just continued on with life and get what he wanted, Ruth as his wife. And in fact, this would have been very much in line with what was going on in that day, where it says everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes. Everyone was acting according to their own selfish best interest. But what we see is that Boaz acts differently. He's different from the culture that's going on there. And he does what is right, even though it's hard. See, it's more important for Boaz to honor God and to respect his people than it is for him to personally profit or to get what he wants. He does the right thing. See, he was prepared to do the right thing even at the risk of losing Ruth, because he had a greater purpose and greater priorities in mind. And this is our first point, that we discover lasting greatness as we trust God's way rather than our own. Lasting greatness comes through submission to God rather than exalting ourselves. A couple years ago, our mission team went to India, and we met a young pastor there. And he was pastoring a little church. And he shared with us the story of how he arrived where he was. And he had been a youth pastor and had been mentored under one of the bishops of that area. And it was decided that it was time for a new role and a new church for him. And he was presented with two options. First was a large church. It offered lots of resources. He would have been set up pretty well, decent pay, relative security and safety for his family. It looked like a promising position. The second option was a tiny, impoverished church in a slum community. It would be hard work there. There would be personal threat to him and his family. Resources would be extremely tight. Every bit of conventional wisdom would suggest that he should go with the larger church. It makes sense. It's what's best for his family, their safety, their security. That's what we would assume would be the choice. But despite the personal benefit, he took it to the Lord, and he felt really in his heart that it was this little church, this poor church, that he was called to. And so rather than go for what was appeared to be best for him, his own prosperity, he chose this poor opportunity. The irony of it all is that a little while later, the large church closed its doors, and the little church continued on and has been thriving and growing, and the Lord's been working greatly through him. You see, we may think that greatness will come through what we take and through prospering ourselves, but sometimes it comes through submitting ourselves to God's way, even when it doesn't make sense. You know, it comes from seeking his will rather than promoting our own agenda and our own preferences. It says we surrender to God's plan and purpose and to his truth that we discover that which will last and that which is truly great. And this is what we saw in that young pastor. Now, as we think about trusting God and trusting his way rather than our own, there's something in verse 1 that I think is helpful for us. It says, as Boaz is sitting by the gate, it says, and behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came along. And what we see here is something that's been running throughout the book of Ruth. Throughout Ruth, there's been this theme of God's providence. And in this, we are to understand that at times, when the details of a story appear coincidental, when something lucky happens, there's more going on than what we see. So when the author writes, behold, he wants us to pause. He wants us to go, wait a minute, there's something going on here. And it's happened before in the book. And he wants us to see that something is happening more than just coincidence or chance. See, the things that appear in the book of Ruth as happenstance are actually God's providence. Now, what do we mean by God's providence? What does this mean? Well, it really means two things. One, it means that God is sovereign, and it means that God is good. It means that God is absolutely in control of everything that is going on in our world, in our lives. Nothing escapes his control and his plan and his purposes. God is sovereign, and he's good. Everything that God does is good, even when it doesn't feel good. He's working for long-term goodness in our lives. And this is what providence means. God is sovereign and He is good in our lives. And He is working out His control and His goodness for the good of His people and for the glory of His name. See, nothing happens apart from God's control, and everything that He does is good, absolutely good. And as we begin to understand this reality, as this truth sinks into our lives, we can begin to understand why we can trust God, why we can defer to His plan rather than our own. Because He's in control, and we recognize, unless we're deluded, we recognize we're not. He's in control, so we can trust Him. And His way is good, and He can see beyond three steps and to know the good that will come of the circumstances of life. But we cannot. So we can trust Him because He is sovereign and good. We can trust Him because of His providence. Now, this doesn't mean that there won't be hard realities in life. It doesn't mean that you trust God and everything is perfect. But what it means is that in the midst of the hard stuff, in the midst of the difficulties, in the midst of the pain, the brokenness, the disappointments, we can know that it's not random, the world's not spinning out of control, but God is in control, and He is good. We can know that. And knowing of God's goodness, knowing of His control, Boaz was able to surrender his agenda to God. He's able to say, yeah, this is what I want, but I'm going to do the right thing, and I'm going to surrender this to God, and I'm going to entrust the outcomes to Him. Boaz was able to do that because he understood God's providence. A clue to this is back in chapter 3 where Boaz speaks to Ruth, and he's there saying, you know, I understand you want me to propose, but there's actually a Redeemer who's first in line. He has first right. And he says, and if He redeems you, good. What an odd thing to say. Ruth wants to marry him. He wants to marry Ruth. But if this other guy gets your hand in marriage, good. And I think he can truly say that because he knows if this is the outcome, I know it's good because it's God at work. And he can rest in that. And so this is what Boaz sees, and I hope this is what we will see, that God is in control, and He is good, and we can release our agendas, our preferences, ultimately to His will, and know that it will be good in the end. See, lasting greatness won't come through self-promotion. It won't come through selfish ambition, but it comes through submitting to God and seeking His way rather than our own. See, a life that is surrendered to God's control, resting in His goodness, will prosper in the long run. This is what we see in the story here. Now, as we continue in verse 1, it's noteworthy. There's an important piece here for us. As Boaz engages his near relative, he calls him friend. Now, when we read this, we just assume it's a normal, friendly greeting. But there's more going on here. See, the Hebrew word that is translated friend, it's kind of this funny word, or two words. It's poloni alimony. Yeah, kind of funny, but which is a Hebrew idiom, and it actually has no meaning. It would be equivalent to calling somebody Mr. So-and-so. So we lose it in translation, but what's happening here is the person's being called Mr. So-and-so or Joe Schmo. Joe Schmo comes along as Boaz was sitting by the gate. No, I think of it like, you know, sometimes there are people that we recognize, but we don't really know, but we know we should know them. We don't know their name, and we go, oh, hey, you! How's it going, buddy? That's kind of what's happening here. The man is nameless. Now, we're going to come back to this a little bit later, but just hold on to that thought. When he says friend, it's actually a person without identity. Now, as the story continues, we see that Boaz gathers 10 of the elders in order to convene this legal council. He's about to settle the matter between Mr. So-and-so, and so he gathers them, and he begins to present this opportunity to the nameless man. And he starts by saying, you know, Naomi is selling some land, and you're the first in line, And so I want to present you with the opportunity to redeem it. Now, as mentioned, based on Old Testament law, a kinsman redeemer was given responsibility to purchase or redeem land that belonged to a family member but was in danger of being lost. So this is what's happening here. So Boaz reminds him, you've got first right, and there's land to be purchased from Naomi for her good, and will you redeem it? Now, in the eyes of this first redeemer, I think he's seeing dollar signs go up here. This looks like a sweet deal because all that's been mentioned is the land. And likely he saw this as an opportunity, one, to fulfill his responsibility, but more so to personally profit as he did. See, he would buy the land. He would likely care for Naomi, which wouldn't be too expensive. But she was beyond childbearing years, so there would be no heir of Elimelech, which would mean, well, he would keep the land. It would become part of his inheritance, part of his family line. So he's sitting there going, that's a pretty good deal. For him, it's win-win. I look good. You know, I do the noble act and redeem, and I get the land. Boaz, yes, I will redeem the land. Absolutely. Now, at this point, we're kind of going like, huh. We're kind of hoping for Boaz and Ruth to get together. Seems like things aren't turning out the way that we want. You know, been rooting for this marriage and this happily ever after, but the Redeemer says he's going to do it. But we're not done yet. See, Boaz isn't finished, and he's calculating. He's shrewd. And so he goes, oh, okay, fair enough. It's your right. And then he says in verse 5, but the day that you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. So Boaz is saying, you know, by the way, when you get the land, you also get Ruth as a wife. And it's going to be your responsibility to have children with her. And your firstborn son, he's going to inherit everything that belonged to Elimelech. So just so it's clear, that's what's happening here, he says to the first redeemer. And it would seem that Ruth is a deal breaker for the guy. She jeopardizes something. All of a sudden, it's like, whoa, okay, wait a minute. Let's slow down here. Because he's calculating this, and he realizes that the cost of redemption just went up exponentially. And all of a sudden, he's no longer willing to act. See, he was all in when it appeared profitable. But when it came clear that the money that he would give to buy the land would likely be lost to him and his direct family line, things changed. He became disinterested in being a redeemer. See, it appears that Mr. So-and-so believes that protecting, promoting his own inheritance is of greater value, worth, significance, importance than helping out a near relative in need and honoring God's law. Ian DeGoot, in his commentary, he speaks of this man and he says this, he was interested in ministry to the poor only if there was payoff for himself and for his family. And then Dean Ulrich continues along these same lines and he said, it's not hard to conclude that the nearer kinsman was a worldly person looking to store up treasures on earth. You see, the first in line was focused on his own interest, his own wealth, his own prosperity, and was willing to put other people in the back seat in order to get it. That was his heart. He saw his future and his prosperity and his legacy through worldly eyes. And it was all too apparent. So now, having turned down the opportunity, the man gives the right of redemption to Boaz. And he does it through this odd tradition where he goes, okay, I'm not going to redeem it, so it's going to be yours. And he takes off his sandal. And he goes, here you go. An odd tradition, and ultimately what's happening there is it's a way that they acknowledge that they were releasing rights that they had to something. They were releasing their rights to redeem this land and giving it to Boaz. So if there was ever a dispute down the road, Boaz could come back and go, I've got your sandal. I don't know why we don't do this anymore. I don't know. I tried it the other day, and I just got odd stares. But yeah, it was just this way in their culture that they would know that rights of something had been released. And they would do it through the exchanging of a sandal. Not really sure exactly where it originated. So he gives up the sandal, hands over the rights, and then Boaz speaks. And he says, "You are witnesses this day." This is verse 8. "You are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon. Also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, the name of the dead that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native places. You are witnesses this day." So Boaz, he restates all that he intends to do. And he says this before the witnesses. But what we want to notice here is his motive. Right? He says, "Yep, I'm going to redeem it. I'm going to do this. I'm going to have Ruth as my wife." And he says, "To perpetuate the name of the dead for his inheritance." You see the difference between Boaz and the first redeemer? He's doing it for his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off. See, Boaz is acting for the good of Naomi, for the good of Ruth, for the good of the family to which they belong, and he gives himself to promote the inheritance of another. See, Boaz is more concerned with the good of others than himself, and he willingly gives of himself at personal cost in order to lift Naomi and Ruth out of their poverty, in order to protect the heritage of Ruth's deceased husband, and to provide an heir who would carry on the family name. Now, do you catch the irony in all of this? See, the first redeemer, he's only concerned with protecting his legacy and his inheritance, and doing whatever he has is to hold on to it. And he ends up nameless in the story. The one who is trying to cling to stuff and to hold on to and hoard his future, he has no identity. See, Boaz surely knew the man's name. The narrator of the story surely knew the man's name. But God chose to give the man a senseless identity and a meaningless name in redemptive history. See, the one who is selfishly trying to save his own name and inheritance, disregarding what is right or having no concern for those who are in need, ends up losing everything that he was trying to protect. The one who is clinging to his inheritance, trying to preserve his name, he ends up nameless in the end. And this leads us to our second point, that we discover lasting greatness as we give ourselves for the good of another. See, the one who humbles himself and considers others more important than himself ends up exalted in the end. Now, this is backwards from what we see in our world. It's backwards from so much of what we hear and what we're told and what we're taught. We're led to believe that lasting greatness comes through self-promotion, that it comes through personal success or personal achievement, and that if we do great things, that will be lasting greatness. But God measures things so differently than our world does. God has a different lens through which he sees greatness. Ian DeGood puts it this way. He says, "We often evaluate our involvement in evangelism and ministries of mercy according to the same scales as Mr. So-and-so. We ask, what's in it for me? Will it fulfill me? Will I enjoy it? What will it cost me?" And in doing the arithmetic, we get answers as completely wrong as he did, because we've left God entirely out of the equation. See, we calculate and we protect ourselves and insist that 2 and 2 can only ever equal 4. But we may never know the blessing that we have lost. We may never know the blessing that we have lost. See, indeed, part of the message of the book of Ruth is that God's kingdom operates on a different kind of calculus, a new math. in which the way to fullness runs through emptiness. Now, some years ago, I was in Cuba with a youth mission team from this church. And there was a day we were at a church outside, kind of the outskirts of Havana, and they had this metal rail fence that we were tasked with painting. It was a super hot day. It was uncomfortable. We're all a little bit grumpy. As we're working, there were kids from the church and the community. They're playing. They're interacting with us. And there was one girl that was kind of hanging around, and we were getting to know. And at one point, she came up, and she was carrying ice cream cones. It's like, oh. And she started handing out a few ice cream cones to a few of us. And I'm like, oh, that was amazing. Amazing. What a treat. What a gift in the midst of that heat. Now, I had assumed that she'd come from the church, that they were scooping these out in their basement, that she was bringing them up to us, only to discover that she had gone with her own money, bought what she could, and gave it to a few of us that she could. She spent herself for the good of these others that had just visited her neighborhood that day. See, through God's lens, that's greatness. Spending oneself for the good of another. That's greatness by kingdom standards. I wonder if we need to take stock of our lives. If we need to ask if there are things that we're holding on to or ways that we're promoting ourselves or ways that we're maybe neglecting others in order for our own comfort and our own needs. Maybe we need to come before God and ask, Lord, is there an area that you want me to loosen my grip? Lord, is there someone you've placed in my life who through me you would want to lift out of poverty or lift out of need or encourage or bring up? Lord, how can I spend my life for the good of others? Maybe this is an opportunity for us to take stock. But what we need to know, what we need to see is that as we do, we won't be disappointed. In the end, you don't lose as you give yourself away. As we give ourselves away for the good of another, we discover true greatness and we discover that which actually lasts in this life and the life to come. You won't lose if you give yourself away. And we see that in the life of Boaz and in this story. Now we come to verse 11. It says, then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. May your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman. So those who were witnesses to this, they get this sense that something big is happening here, and they begin to speak these blessings over Boaz and Ruth and their family. And the first blessing is that Ruth would be like Rachel and Leah, and they were the matriarchs of the Israelite nation. And so it's a blessing that speaks to them having you know, children, and that their children would be significant in God's redemptive plans. It's an interesting blessing in prayer because, you know, what we know from earlier in the story is that Ruth had gone 10 years childless in marriage. But these people go, in God's providence, you can have kids, and may those kids be used by God greatly. So it's a really cool blessing here that's spoken over them. The second blessing is that Boaz would be renowned, that he'd be a worthy man, that he would continue in this way. And again, we see this idea of the one who humbles himself is exalted. And we see that playing out here. And then the third one, it's a little bit different. The third blessing, he says, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. Because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman. Now, if you're familiar with the story of Judah, Tamar, and Perez, you recognize that it's a little bit of an odd blessing. Like, I don't think I would speak this blessing over anyone in this room. It seems strange. So the story is found in Genesis 38. there's this guy, Judah. He's one of the 12 tribes of Israel. And he has three sons. There's Ur, Onan, and Shelah. Now, the oldest, Ur, he marries Tamar. But he was a wicked guy. So the Lord kills him. And they don't have any kids. See, it's not going so well already. So Judah, he gave the second, Onan, to Tamar to marry her and to produce a child for the late husband, Ur. Well, Onan's a wicked dude as well, and he doesn't want to fulfill his responsibility. Lord kills him. What kind of blessing is this? So now Judah's a little bit worried. He's like, okay, I've got one more son. I'm doing the math. If I give this son to Tamar, it doesn't look good. So he decides to withhold his youngest son from Tamar and to cause her to be a childless widow. Now, she's not crazy about this. She's a little bit ticked off. She's not happy about this. So she after a while, she devises this plan. She goes, okay, I'm going to go dress like a prostitute. I'm going to disguise myself so that Judah won't recognize me, and then I'm going to have him proposition me. I'm going to have him sleep with me, and I'm going to have him impregnate me so that I have a child. And the plan worked. Judah comes along, sees her, propositions her, and she gets pregnant. This story is a little bit different than the story of Ruth, isn't it? It's not quite so beautiful, not quite so pure, not quite as desirable. It's kind of nasty. Now, the child of Judah and Tamar, the oldest, they had twins, but the oldest is named Perez. And what we discover is that Perez is the great-great-great-great-granddad of Boaz. And what we know from Steve's spoiler in week one is that that would make Perez part of the lineage of King David and ultimately part of the lineage of Jesus. So what we discover here is that even in the story of Judah and Tamar, even when humanity is at its worst, God is at work redeeming brokenness, making a way for a better, complete restoration that would come through Jesus. It's reminding us of redemption and is pointing to Jesus. And this is what we see as it references Judah and Tamar and Perez. See, in the story of Boaz and Ruth and in the story of Judah and Tamar, we're reminded that these stories are not really about how great people are or how they deserve good things. That's not what Ruth is about. But it's about God's grace and his redemption at work in and through them. See, the inclusion of Judah and Tamar and Perez is a reminder that it's God who redeems. It's him who takes the mess of humanity and brings forth good out of it. He did that in the story of Judah and Tamar. He did that in the story of Boaz and Ruth. And it's what he wants to do in our lives too. Take the mess, redeem it, and bring forth good. And this brings us to our third and final point, that we find lasting greatness through God's redeeming work in our lives. See, the good news according to the book of Ruth points beyond the beauty of what God did through Boaz and Ruth and Naomi to a greater redemption that would come through Jesus. It's redemption that has meaning for this life, but also for life to come. In Romans 3:23, it says that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. This means that regardless of who we are, where we come from, our social status, our giftedness, or our wealth, we all come into this world on equal footing. That because of sin, we're cut off from God and in need of his grace. But God has not left us without hope. In kindness, he gave his son, Jesus, in order to redeem us and restore our relationship with him. And through Jesus' life, death, and resurrection, God made provision for our sin by paying the debt that we owe, and he gives the eternal life to those who place their faith in Jesus. And it's a gift of grace. It's not something we earn. It's not because of our greatness. It's because God is great. You see, ultimately, the story of Ruth is pointing us to that redemption. the redemption that we need. And it's only available through Jesus, only available through him. And this is the gospel according to the book of Ruth. It's the good news that is given to each of us today. But we got to understand that it is news that calls for a response. It calls for faith in Christ. It calls trusting his greatness rather than our own. And through that, we ultimately discover lasting greatness. Now, as we think about this passage, we discover that lasting greatness comes in unexpected ways. It's kind of backwards from what the world says. It's counterintuitive. See, in God's kingdom, the way up is down. The way down is up. Exaltation comes through humility, prosperity by giving oneself away. Greatness is exalting God's agenda before our own, as we put ourselves before others. But none of this happens apart from God's redeeming work in our lives. This is why this third point is so important. We won't have the capacity or the ability to give ourselves away or to give ourselves fully to God's agenda if we aren't changed by Jesus. So for the other two to be true, we need the third to be true in our life. We need God's redeeming work in our lives through Jesus Christ. Jesus is the gateway to greatness. As we exalt him and live for him and submit to him and proclaim his greatness, that we'd actually discover lasting greatness. And this is the good news according to the Gospel of Ruth.